It's 7:43. I'm Teresa Wills. On this West Virginia morning, we meet the Division II candidates running for the West Virginia Supreme Court.
It's very tough to communicate with voters in a crowded field where whoever wins will very likely not achieve a majority.
Plus, your voting questions answered. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Workers across the Ohio Valley are facing difficult choices now that states are gradually reopening workplaces. Many don't feel safe going back to work, and adding to the anxiety is the uncertainty about the enforcement of safety standards for businesses that are welcoming customers back. Becca Schimmel has more.
Gail Fleck is a school cafeteria worker in the greater Cincinnati area and lives with her 90-year-old father. She loves her job because she gets to work with kids, but she's worried she won't be able to keep her dad safe if her work exposes her to the coronavirus and she unknowingly brings it home.
I'm scared. I'm worried. I feel like, you know, we're talking about life and death here, you know. This is my father.
Fleck, who didn't want to name her employer, said she hasn't been back to work since before the schools went on spring break. When she ran out of sick days, she stopped receiving a paycheck.
You know, I've just worked very hard at keeping myself and my father at home and not going out.
Workers like Fleck across the Ohio Valley are weighing whether or not it's safe to go back to work now that more businesses are reopening. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration is the main federal agency responsible for enforcing workplace safety standards. Some have criticized the federal program's lack of involvement in workplaces during the coronavirus pandemic.
The sad reality is that OSHA is failing here. They've actually just walked away from this whole pandemic and decided that though they could, they're not going to do any enforcement.
That's Deborah Berkowitz, Safety and Health Program Director at the left-leaning nonprofit National Employment Law Project. Previously, she was Chief of Staff and Senior Policy Advisor for OSHA under the Obama administration. She says if employers are not following the Centers for Disease Control guidance, employees should file a complaint with OSHA.
And even though they're not going to go out and do an inspection, I think they will call the employer and say a complaint has been filed.
During pointed questioning at a congressional hearing, a top official with OSHA was not able to say how many workplaces are seeing cases of COVID-19. National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health Director John Howard says his organization has just started tracking coronavirus cases in the workplace. That's about 2 months after the virus was declared a pandemic.
We have been getting better at tracking occupation and industry for COVID-19 cases. We have a new case report form that we are hoping that the states will start using.
Howard says NIOSH is now beginning to track coronavirus cases in meatpacking plants. Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia have all seen large outbreaks in meat processing facilities as workers try to keep up with soaring demand from consumers. The three states have been working to reopen their economies a few sectors at a time. Tom Tsai is an assistant professor at Harvard's Global Health Institute. He says states should be prepared to dial back their reopening if cases begin to accelerate again.
The states need to really consider having very clear metrics on what success or failure looks like.
Tsai said there is already some social distancing fatigue people are feeling, and that's why it's important to get the policy correct now.
Once the floodgates open, in terms of trying to return to normal, it's going to be very hard to re-institute social distancing measures that have been placed.
Now restaurants are opening to in-person dining as well as recreational activities, fitness centers, and cosmetology services. Many of the facilities won't be the same as they were pre-pandemic, with limited occupancy and increased personal protective equipment for customers and workers. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel.
Yesterday, we heard from the candidates running for Division I of the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. Today, we'll learn about the four candidates running in Division II. As Dave Mistich reports, candidates from Division II have expressed remarkably different ideas about what the state's high court should focus on.
Judge Jim Douglas hears cases in the state's 11th Family Court Circuit. which serves Kanawha County. Douglas argues that much of the state's legal caseload is made up of proceedings like those he oversees.
The family law appeals to the West Virginia Supreme Court have for the last several years run more than the criminal appeals. So it is absolutely imperative that someone be on the Supreme Court that has that experience.
Although the legislative branch sets judicial salaries, Douglas says he would advocate for pay for those working within the family court system to be equal to other parts of the judiciary. He also believes the court should be better connected to residents throughout the state.
Historically, we've had and held arguments. I've participated in arguments before the Supreme Court, over 40 cases before the Supreme Court. And we've gone to different places like Morgantown. We've gone to Charleston. But why can't you get a whole court in any of the courthouses across the other 55 counties? Whether it be Grantsville, whether it be Princeton, whether it be Marlington, and let people see that the Supreme Court is just peopled by real persons, real humans.
Putnam County Assistant Prosecutor Christina Chris Raines is also running for a seat on the Supreme Court. She points out that most of the cases in the state's judicial system do not fall under the jurisdiction of family court.
The large majority of those cases in the family law category, I'm checking the stats right now, are abuse and neglect cases. Those are not handled by family court judges. They're handled by prosecutors and circuit judges. So the majority of the cases that the court will hear are criminal appeals and abuse and neglect cases, all handled by prosecutors.
Raines acknowledges that while West Virginia Supreme Court elections are nonpartisan, the races are still colored by partisan politics.
I am the sole conservative in Division II race. My opponents all have Democratic political pasts. I am endorsed by the West Virginia Republican Party, West Virginians for Life, the West Virginia Family Policy Council, and the Associated Builders and Contractors, as well as a few other online endorsements that I've recently received.
While three of the five sitting justices on the state's high court have not presided over circuit court, Judge Joanna Tabbitt argues that experience is necessary. Tabbitt hears cases in West Virginia's 13th Judicial Circuit in Kanawha County.
Now more than ever, as I've said, our court needs proven qualified judges, and that's why I'm running. Basically, the Supreme Court is reviewing the decision of circuit court judges. It's important for an individual sitting at that appellate level to have sat at the level I'm at right now as a circuit judge and made those decisions at the court, called the balls and the strikes. It, in my view, is critical.
Tabbitt also says the court system has come a long way since the spending scandal that dramatically changed the makeup of the bench in 2018. However, she says there are other reforms that could be implemented, including evaluating the court's recusal policy.
I think it's important for a justice who is deciding to sit on a case to explain the reasons why he or she believes it's appropriate for him or her to sit on the case. And I think it's important for also there to be accountability in the rest of the court taking a look at that decision and making a determination as to whether or not that's appropriate. I don't know that it needs to be the entire court. Perhaps the majority is sufficient.
Bill Wooten of Raleigh County spent 26 years in the West Virginia legislature, including 10 years as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Like other candidates for Supreme Court, Wooten acknowledges and is concerned with the vast number of abuse and neglect cases in the state's judicial system.
The underlying problem in West Virginia that is responsible for the growth in the abuse and neglect cases and most of the other domestic relations cases is the underlying opioid crisis. That problem has to be dealt with. The magnitude of the problem is beyond the scope of the judicial system to deal with it. The executive branch and the legislative branch must find more creative and effective methods of dealing with it.
As the election of judges in West Virginia is nonpartisan, Wooten says that political parties should not interfere by offering endorsements. He also says that the way that justices are elected is still problematic.
I think that having a quote nonpartisan election coinciding with the primary, and that being the only election, I think that deprives the voters of the opportunity to learn a sufficient amount of knowledge about the candidates to make informed choices. It's very tough to communicate with voters in a crowded field where whoever wins will very likely not achieve a majority.
The Republican State Leadership Committee has spent more than $7,300 supporting Raines in the race for Division II. Reset West Virginia, another independent expenditure attempting to influence the Supreme Court elections, has spent more than $219,000 in support of Tabbitt. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
To learn more about the candidates for the West Virginia Supreme Court, tune in Thursday, June 4th at 6 p.m. for a two-hour candidate forum that includes 9 of the 10 jurists running across the 3 divisions. That program airs on West Virginia Public Broadcasting Television stations and will also be available online at wvpublic.org. Our news team has been fielding questions from outside and inside the newsroom during the voting season. Glennis Board spoke with Brittany Patterson about some basic voting questions. Here's some of their conversation.
To be fair, for many of us, our civics or social studies class was a lot longer ago than we'd like to admit. And it's kind of a crazy election year with this whole coronavirus pandemic and such. So, you know, it's a no judgment zone here. We just wanted to answer some questions that might have come up among the staff.
For example, what is a magistrate exactly?
Yeah, you know, I am not the only one who didn't know this. And so a magistrate is a judge that often hears cases related to small crimes, including misdemeanors. So if you didn't know this, that's probably good. We're talking speeding tickets, other civil violations in which you'd be cited and then you'd probably be released. You'd also see a magistrate if you were involved in a preliminary examination in either a felony or a civil case in which whatever's at dispute is less than $10,000. They also issue things like protective orders related to domestic violence cases. And sometimes they also handle involuntary hospitalization cases. I guess one thing that's really interesting and important to note about a magistrate judge is there's at least 2 in every county, and they do not need a law degree or to have entered into the state bar.
Yeah, that surprised me. I didn't realize that. I had no idea. Okay, so moving on next. Another question that we've actually gotten a lot of, I think, in the newsroom is questions about registered party affiliation and how that affects which primary we vote in. So can you explain what the situation is here in West Virginia with the primaries and registered party affiliation?
All over the United States, what party you're registered in and what primary you can vote in is different. So here in West Virginia, we have a hybrid or semi-closed primary. And what that basically means is if you're registered as a Republican, you vote in the Republican primary. Same if you're a Democrat. Registered as one party, you vote in that party's primary. However, if you're registered no party affiliation, you can choose which party's ballot you'd like to receive and vote in the primary election. That doesn't mean you can jump from party between races, like the president versus the governor versus the Senate. You get to choose one party's ballot for all the races. But if you're no party affiliation, you do get to choose.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it too late to change party affiliation at this point for the primary? It is, isn't it?
It is, yes. The deadline to register to vote or change your party affiliation is 21 days before each election. For the June 9th primary election, that deadline was May 19th.
There was concern about spreading coronavirus through mail. So do we need to worry about this, especially regarding mail-in ballots?
So I am not a scientist. And researchers are still learning a lot about the coronavirus. However, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the main source of the coronavirus's spread is person-to-person. And person-to-person contact through respiratory droplets when someone coughs or sneezes, talks or sings in close proximity to someone else. That being said, the CDC also has recommendations on its website that if you go get the mail, they recommend after that happens, you wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds or use a hand sanitizer. There has been some evidence that the virus can survive on surfaces like cardboard for up to 24 hours. But again, the CDC says at this point, they don't think surface transmission, especially through the mail, is the main way that the virus spreads. That being said, you know, because the main source of spread is person to person, you know, voting with your absentee ballot is definitely less risky than if you were going to vote in person.
Let's talk for a minute about provisional ballots and how those work, because that's sort of been a muddled area in my mind for a while. I'm looking for some clarity. How do the provisional ballots work?
The takeaway here is if you go to vote on Election Day, you cannot be turned away in West Virginia. If the clerk says, oh, I can't find you, or the addresses don't match, or something happens, request a provisional ballot. They are the fail-safe if there are some sort of errors or if it's not clear if you can vote or not. You know, I think what's so interesting about provisional ballots is that it comes down to each county's board of canvassers to decide whether or not they're going to accept your provisional ballot. And each county board of canvassers is made up of different people, often county commissioners. And so they basically go to the county clerk and figure out how much information they can find out about you and decide if you really are who you say you are, and therefore can they accept your ballot. But that process is you know, different on a county by county level. You can track the status of your provisional ballot by checking with your local county clerk's office.
That was reporter Brittany Patterson speaking with Glynis Board. We have more election coverage online at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Brittany Patterson produces our show. Our news director is Glynis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.